healing is an unending process, and that's okay. You're not alone. You can come back from anything. You know, you can hit rock bottom and still make something beautiful out of it. We are given a choice in those dark moments, in the moments of tragedy. Will you choose to allow it to make you stronger, or will you choose to allow it to break you beyond repair?
One of the most beloved guests in the history of this podcast is ultra runner Tommy Rives. What he learned from a near fatal brush with a rare form of lung cancer and his remarkable return to both life and sport has and continues to touch millions of people.
Yeah, just stoked that I'm just still around, you know?
If you count yourself among those impacted by his powerful story, so beautifully told, then you are going to love Steph Kochadal, an equally soulful, gifted writer who shares her life and the experience of almost losing her husband, Tommy, in her stunning and very intimate New York Times bestselling memoir, Everything All at Once. This conversation is really about all the big things. It's about trauma and grief and suffering. It's about faith. It's about rebellion. But it's also about how to recognize gratitude, love, and beauty amid the tragedy, while also holding space for emotions like pain, anger, and sorrow. In other words, how to allow everything all at once. I was very moved by Steph's book. Her openness and vulnerability in this conversation is powerful. I think you'll find it quite impactful. And it's all coming up. So here we go. This is me and Steph Kochadal. We're brought to you today by On. I am a total gearhead. I love researching the latest technology for the sports I enjoy. And I've learned that people often overlook apparel. But what you wear isn't just clothes. It is, without a doubt, technology. Technology that can make or break a performance. And I can tell you, after spending two full days meeting with the apparel wizards at On Labs in Zurich, that On is innovating in this space like no other, with next-gen premium fabrics and just this heightened level of sophistication and precision and testing and development and intentionality previously unheard of that puts them just miles beyond the competition. I've been rocking On's high-performance running apparel, including the long tees, the weather jackets, even the climate jacket, all super lightweight, tailor fit, built to move, and just gorgeous to get you out and get it done in fleet-foot comfort no matter the weather. I'm super proud to be a brand partner with this impressive team. From increasing product sustainability to improved energy return and impact protection, truly Swiss innovation at its finest. To get you moving, On is offering an exclusive 10% discount. To redeem, head over to on.com/richroll and use code RICHROLL10 at checkout. We're brought to you today by recovery.com. I've been in recovery for a long time. It's not hyperbolic to say that I owe everything good in my life to sobriety. And it all began with treatment, an experience that I had that quite literally saved my life. And in the many years since, I've in turn helped many suffering addicts and their loved ones find treatment. And with that, I know all too well just how confusing and how overwhelming and how challenging it can be to find the right place and the right level of care, especially because, unfortunately, not all treatment resources adhere to ethical practices. It's a real problem, a problem I'm now happy and proud to share has been solved by the people at recovery.com, who created an online support portal designed to guide, to support, and empower you to find the ideal level of care tailored to your personal needs. They've partnered with the best global behavioral health providers to cover the full spectrum of behavioral health disorders, including substance use disorders, depression, anxiety, eating disorders, gambling addictions, and more. Navigating their site is simple. Search by insurance coverage, location, treatment type, you name it. Plus, you can read reviews from former patients to help you decide. Whether you're a busy exec, a parent of a struggling teen, or battling addiction yourself, I feel you. I empathize with you. I really do. And they have treatment options for you. Life in recovery is wonderful, and recovery.com is your partner in starting that journey. When you or a loved one need help, go to recovery.com and take the first step towards recovery. To find the best treatment option for you or a loved one, again, go to recovery.com.
I'm super proud to announce my next venture, Voicing Change Media. This beautiful consortium of thinkers, storytellers, artists, and visionaries all committed to fostering meaningful exchanges and sharing thought-provoking content. Voicing Change Media will feature shows like The Proof with Simon Hill, Soul Boom with Rainn Wilson, Mentor Buffet with Alexi Pappas, Feel Better, Live More with Dr. Rangan Chatterjee, and The Conversation with Amanda Decadene. You can explore this network and all its offerings at voicingchange.media. Steph, it's so nice to meet you. I've been looking forward to this for such a long time. So welcome to the show. I can't wait to get into your life, this fantastic new book that is now a New York Times bestseller. Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's amazing. Everything All at Once. The process of writing it, I'm interested in what that was like for you and if you had any additional sort of discoveries about yourself and life as a result of doing that that perhaps you wouldn't have had short of the writing itself.
Yeah. Writing this book was really, really difficult for me. I had to heal. Well, it's an ongoing process. I was healing from the trauma of what happened to me in real time as I was writing. So I think that's why the book is so raw. And because I was still in that emotionally raw state when I was writing it, I was deeply depressed when I was writing it as well. I feel like it was the come down from this post-traumatic stress, you know, experience that I was having. And I think that comes out in the pages. And even when I read it now, I can't access that same depth of emotion.
Right.
And I think I had to write it in that state for it to be as true as it was when I was writing it.
Yeah. I would suspect 5 years from now, 10 years from now, you may reflect back on it and have a different relationship with it or
Absolutely.
Experience. And I think the process of then putting a book out into the world means that you sit down with people like me and you talk a lot about what's in the book. And and I think that in and of itself then continues to inform your own kind of journey of self-understanding. Like it will continue to reveal newer and newer layers of that.
Yeah, well, what I'm, one of the most important things that I'm learning and learned throughout writing the book is that healing is never ending. It's an unending process, and that's okay. And there's no finality in my book because I was realizing there's no finality to grief or and I'm sure I'll look back on this book, like you said, in 5 and 10 years and kind of look back on myself with almost like a childlike fondness, you know, that I was so new in my healing.
Yeah.
And I think that's a beautiful thing to accept that we're just all on this healing journey and there's no final destination. Yeah. You know, it's just ongoing.
Yeah. I think it's a beautiful and healthy response to it. This book is actually an extrapolation of an earlier book that you were writing about you confronting and making peace with and healing the experience of losing your father to lung cancer, a story that you thought was complete at the time. And it was only through what happened with Riz that you realized like that was just, you know, sort of pre-intermission,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And the story still had you know, much to tell you. I think if you had put that book out prior, you would have missed the magic and all the messiness and the pain, of course, of what you experienced that now gives you kind of a gravitas to share from a new level. And the narrative of the book is structured such that you toggle back and forth between that original story, which is kind of a linear chronology of your life, peppered in between with chapters about what is going on with Rivs and how that reflects upon experiences you had as a younger person.
Yeah, well, that first half of the book, so all of the even chapters are roughly the book that I wrote from when the past decade. And I actually finished that version of the book and I called it This Is Where I Leave You because I actually thought that I was leaving my grief behind, that that grief was something that could be left behind. And I felt like as though I had finished grieving the death of my father, which now to me is just really interesting or even comical that I thought that you can finish grieving. And when Rives got sick, that narrative obviously got cracked wide open. And one of the most impactful things that I learned about myself is that I hadn't finished grieving the death of my father because you never finish grieving. And in order to truly accept the wholeness of myself, I had to accept that that void left by my father's death would always be there. And that's okay. Mm-hmm. And then it became, what tools do you use to fill that void that are not self-destructive? And that's the journey I'm on now, currently. Still real time. I'm that's where I'm at, because I learned that to accept that hole or that void inside of me. And now I'm trying to figure out ways to not fill it, but to just deal with it in more productive ways.
Yeah. You're a seeker. You know, you're somebody who at a very early age was looking for answers in lots of different ways, not always so healthy, right?
Yeah.
You know, ran away from home at 16. There's drugs and alcohol involved. You grappling with your relationship to being raised Mormon and what does spirituality mean? What does prayer mean? Things like this.
Yep.
You were always looking for answers. And I think part of this narrative is that you're running away in the searching, right? Mm-hmm. You think you're running towards answers, but you're actually running away from what's right in front of you, which is confronting the truth of your father's passing and what that meant to you and how that affected you, and trying to figure out, you know, what does God mean and what is my purpose, and all these sort of unprogramming, you know, some of the dogma that was instilled in you from a religious perspective as a young person. And it required what happened to Rives in order for you to stop, because you couldn't turn away for the first time in your life, and you had to confront it. Mm-hmm. And it's just fucking crazy, because your dad passes from lung cancer and then Rives gets lung cancer. I mean, you cannot script this or make this up.
Yeah.
It's like this insane, like, collision of, you know, truth that the universe conspired to put in your path in order for your own self-discovery and growth.
Yeah, well, there's a part in my book where I think it'd been 2 days since we got Rives' final diagnosis, which was the lung cancer. And I was with my sister, and we were just floating in an Airbnb pool, kind of in this purgatory of waiting for me to be able to visit Rives in the hospital. And I said the words aloud. I said, "My husband has fucking lung cancer." And we just laughed and laughed and laughed. It was just this cathartic, just recognizing this cruel irony that, like you said, just almost like the universe just shaking me, saying, "You need to learn this lesson." And I don't necessarily think that things happen for a reason. I don't like to think that my dad died for a reason or that Rives got sick for a reason. I think that's dangerous territory for me personally. But looking back, I can assign meaning to what happened for my own self.
Yeah, that's a choice.
Yeah, that's the choice I made, was to say, my dad died. That was just purely tragic. But from his passing and from the response that his grief made me feel in the ways that I acted, taught me better and equipped me to better deal with my husband's diagnosis. And then my husband's diagnosis, in turn, in this cyclical nature, helped me heal from my father's passing.
Right.
And so it was this it felt like this cosmic, I felt like I was on a train, and everything that was happening during that year and a half was a stop that I was supposed to get off at and then get back on the train. Mm-hmm. That's how it felt.
Right, with the question, where is the opportunity for my own personal evolution and all of this in the midst of the chaos and the pain and everything else.
Mm-hmm. And I think also what we talked about, me searching for answers and searching for meaning, during my adolescence and everything, in the wake of my father's death, what I came to find was that I had been searching outside myself for this placation or for the answers.
Don't we all?
I mean, of course, yeah. but especially because I was raised Mormon. And so mm-hmm. I was taught that power lives outside of us, that we submit to the power. And I think that's good in some ways because it brings humility and, you know, lessening of the ego. But what I found was that I held the power inside of me and that I could find the healing. And it wasn't an outside source. It was mm-hmm. innate in me. I was born with that power. And it was just learning how to access it. And it was love that taught me that.
Yeah. The first stop being Mormonism and the final stop on that train tour being RIVs, mm-hmm. thinking that the answers that you were seeking yeah. could be found in this relationship mm-hmm. with this extraordinary human being. And not until the kind of frailness, of his physical self became evident, were you able to understand that he was not your solution mm-hmm. either,
yeah.
right? That it's between you and you.
Yeah. And that was a really sad reckoning, because it wasn't until he was sedated and in a coma, essentially, that I realized that I had been blaming him for a lot of my deficiencies because he didn't heal me. Mm-hmm. He didn't make me whole. Therefore, there was something wrong with him. And I only, as I was sitting by his bed, was I realizing how many moments and events I had blamed him for, when it was really all my responsibility. My happiness was only mine. He couldn't give me that happiness, right. that wholeness. And I had been blaming him. And part of this urgency of wanting him to wake up was for me to apologize for saying, I'm sorry, I expected you to heal me. What mm-hmm. an untenable demand, you know, like right. how, but I think a lot of us do that. I think that came from the wound of my father's death, of this, you know, feeling like, you need to stay here because you're going to replace my dad, you know,
right.
which is...
and thinking that you had resolved that grief and mm-hmm. overcome that trauma only to discover that you hadn't,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep.
I've been thinking a lot about that. That's beautifully said. And I made some notes that I want to share, so I'm going to refer to them. I was thinking about what you just said and also reflecting on a recent personal experience that I had. And I posted this thing on social media yesterday about trauma. And I said, I'm convinced that one of, if not the most important keys to living well requires redress and healing of past or mm-hmm. childhood traumas. Basically arresting the dysfunctional behaviors that we've inherited by our ancestry that recur unconsciously and reactively, adopting new healthier ways of living and instilling these more adaptive patterns as default settings in the next generation is a most worthy and esteemable pursuit and the path to freedom. And as I think about your story and thinking about the many ways in which you were kind of running away from yourself and mm-hmm. your pain through religion, prayer, geographics, drugs, you're dabbling with sobriety and AA and mm-hmm. psychedelics. But the truth and ultimately the lie is that this solace that you end up experiencing and believing that everything you were looking for, you end up finding in RIVs, mm-hmm. right? This empath, mm-hmm. to use your own phrase,
yep.
this very sensitive human being mm-hmm. Who's kind of like, from an outsider's perspective, almost like a bodhisattva-like figure.
yeah.
You know, he's incredibly charismatic. Yeah. He's larger than life. He's very strong and seemingly invincible, mm-hmm. this protector. But he also exudes this really beautiful quality of love and, you know, benevolence mm-hmm. and kindness that ends up not just comforting you, but comforting a lot of people.
Yeah.
But that is very bright sunlight, mm-hmm. right? That power ends up eclipsing your own power and ultimately mm-hmm. yeah. works at cross purposes with your own growth. It prevents and delays you from confronting yourself, confronting your past. It arrests your healing. It keeps you disconnected.
Mm-hmm.
And you can choose to believe or perceive in this whole experience that on some level, his disease is this gift that mm-hmm. he's giving you for your own evolution. Because finally, like I said earlier, you can't, for the first time, you can't run away.
Mm-hmm.
You're compelled to confront your past and heal it and ultimately become whole. And in the telling of this story in this book, you are passing this on.
Mm-hmm.
You're not only passing it on in the way that you're parenting your daughters so that they don't sort of inherit the same behavior response to trauma that you did, mm-hmm. but by sharing it with your words, you have this vehicle to empower other people, which is just, you know, like, that's it, man. Mm. Like, that's the shit, right?
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
what we're here to do. We're yeah. here to grow, evolve, yeah. and then share what we learned along the way.
Yeah. It's still a daily practice, though. It's not as though I figured it out because mm-hmm. I wrote this book and therefore I am now healed from codependency and, you know, all of these things that I still have to make a conscious choice to not let the trauma child inside me act out because she's still there. We never get rid of our trauma selves, I don't think. But accepting and recognizing that that's what's causing us to act out in certain ways is liberating for me because mm-hmm. then I can feel her yelling and being insecure and then I can recognize her rather than just pretend it's someone else's problem. And so that's a daily practice that I am trying to work at is hearing my trauma self and then acting in a way that's not blaming or destructive.
Mm-hmm. But that's part of everything, you know, all at once,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
It's the full spectrum of emotions
yep.
and learning how to be in a place of self-acceptance with those rather mm-hmm. than trying to hold yourself up to some perfectionist standard of how you're supposed to respond yeah. to a difficult situation.
Absolutely. And not fighting against it. I think I felt, I tried so hard my whole life to fight against depression, fight against anxiety, to battle it and push it away. And it isn't until I'm beginning now to just allow it and accept it
mm-hmm.
and almost make it my friend and my teacher and my companion that I'm able to move forward rather than staying stuck in the same patterns.
Yeah.
And
that might have come across in some of those AA meetings you
yeah.
went to when you were in your early
yeah,
20s or
right?
whatever.
yeah.
Surrender, acceptance.
Yeah, surrender. I
yeah.
mean, but that's the thing is, and also what I'm learning is that truth is found everywhere. You know, truth is found in the Mormon religion and in AA and in psychedelics. It's found everywhere. It's just you find your avenue that resonates most with you.
Mm-hmm.
And, but we're all saying the same thing. We're all saying the same thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's beautiful when you can recognize that we're all just little trauma kids trying to heal in this
yeah.
life.
Yeah, it's your story is unique to you, and yet it's kind of the oldest story.
Mm-hmm,
it's like
mm-hmm.
I ran around the world looking for answers
yeah.
only to arrive back home and realize they were within me
yeah,
all the time.
Yeah, I mean,
you know?
It is.
yeah,
it,
yeah.
And that's what I feel like pain is universal, but we experience it so personally, and it feels mm-hmm. so personal to us. And part of the reason I wrote this book was I wanted people to know that you're not alone. Like, I gave every greedy detail to let people know that whatever they're doing to cope with their tragedy or their trauma, that if they could use it as a vehicle to self-improvement, then you can come back from anything. You know, you can hit rock bottom like I more or less did and still make something beautiful out of it.
Mm-hmm. It's one thing to, you know, navigate the challenges of a loved one who's succumbing to cancer. And it's another thing entirely to do that under the public eye.
Mm.
Like you and your husband are both
mm-hmm.
people who are sort of well known. And I'm wondering how that impacted how you were dealing with it privately and then realizing like there's a public out there that wants to be apprised of what's happening
mm-hmm.
moment by moment and the tension between trying to protect your family and you know, navigate a very personal thing with the demands of people that are in some kind of parasocial relationship
yeah.
with you that you've never met.
Yeah. Well, and I think that was heightened by the fact that it was COVID. So everyone was
right.
isolated and lonely and living virtually. So everyone was in these parasocial relationships at the time. And so I think that just heightened and intensified the connection people felt with our story. It was double-edged, I would say. For on one hand, the love and support that we got from people around the world really was a saving grace. It really did make me feel far less lonely in a very lonely time when mm-hmm. I was quarantining and away from my friends. And at the same time, there was this expectation that their love bought a ticket to our lives. And I wasn't willing to share everything because some things were too sacred to share. And also Rives is a very, very private person. And I knew, even though he was unconscious, I knew he wouldn't want me to be taking pictures and sharing them online. Right. I never once shared a picture of him sick. I knew that if he woke up, he could tell the story how he wanted to. And that's why I chose to tell it only from my emotional self. I didn't really give many medical updates. I mostly gave emotionally updates because that felt respectful.
Right. And the writing that you share on Instagram predates Rives' illness. I mean, this is something you've been doing for a long time. And, you know, there's lots of people out there who fell in love with you simply for your way with words. So the book in many ways is just an extrapolation of that talent. It was only a matter of time before you wrote a book, whatever it was going to be about.
I was already writing one, but yeah.
Yeah. And there's a, you know, there's a Zen Cohen like sort of flair to some of your posts, but they're always very sort of layered and deep and thoughtful and honest. But I'm wondering, you know, I think there's this, before Rives got sick, there's this sort of perception of an idealized life, right? He's got this extraordinary physique. He's super handsome. He's just an athletic machine. You're very beautiful. You have these beautiful daughters. And the projection is one of maybe not perfection, but an aspirational life.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, you know, that crashes into a wall. And you're faced with, you know, I don't know if this is anything you even think about, but I'm just wondering, you know, as somebody, as an outsider looking in, like, wow, people are projecting onto you a version of your life that isn't reality.
Yeah.
Then do you feel a responsibility to disabuse people of that or to try to communicate with people in a way that still is providing them with something like teachable moments or something aspirational out of what you were enduring in real time?
Yeah, well, the truth is the couple years before Rives got sick were probably some of the hardest years for us personally and in our marriage. He was injured in the Houston Marathon, so he couldn't run. And when Rives can't run, he gets very dark.
Yeah.
I mean, we're just a normal married couple. We got married when I was 22 years old and he was 23. We were just babies. And so we had to learn to grow up together, and we did not do it perfectly. And I think people have this idea that we've figured it out because he was able to, you know, reach his goal of being a career athlete. And I was able to reach my goal of being a writer, but it did not come without many struggles and many fights and many resentments that we still work through now. And so to hear people say that, you know, we seem like we're the ideal couple or that we're couple goals, we cringe when people say couple goals only because we're not. We're definitely not. Like but what we do well is we encourage each other's independence, and we've always done that. And I think that for us is really important because we are both very lone wolf, independent people. And I think that's what brought us together in the first place. But I never felt a sense of duty to the public to give off any particular, image of who we were. I'm sorry if we gave off the image that we were perfect, because we're definitely not.
No, I'm not saying it was intentional on
your exactly.
part.
Yeah, exactly. No,
I think
but that's
easy to sort of like extrapolate.
Absolutely.
From that, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And Rives especially really, really doesn't like that. I'm very passive. Like, I don't dwell on things as much as he does. He is definitely a deep, deep thinker, as you know. And he's always thinking about what will people garner from this. And so we're trying to now kind of deconstruct the notion that we are this, I don't know, perfect couple have it figured out.
On an almost sort of mythic level, though, when I think about Rives and, you know, to your point of him being this empath and being a very sensitive person, and even you write about this in the book, the fact that he, you know, he needs to go out into nature and engage with solitude so that he can ground himself and, you know, process like all the energy that he takes on from everyone around him. It's almost like he's a cleanser for others, right?
Yeah.
And I can't help but think, like in this sort of archetypal way, you know, the illness that he got, like, mm-hmm. was this because, like, he reached his max in his ability to kind of process, you know, other people's toxicity. And he was doing it, you know, in a selfless way for others.
Yeah. Well, he always talks about it as a gift and a curse, and mostly a curse, that his ability to absorb other people's emotions. Because to the person that he's helping, obviously it's a gift, but he doesn't know how to metabolize that emotion other than running. And so when he doesn't get to run, again, it just sits in him. And he always says, I feel like I'm rotting. And I think that's really, really heavy for him. And then to be partnered with someone like that, you do need to understand their need to be alone for hours and hours at a time. And that was part of my learning experience as a 22-year-old newly married, to say, why does my husband want to be gone six or seven hours a day? And it took me a long time to realize that he needs that, because he is, like you said, this archetypal figure that he is quite literally healing himself and others. And when he got sick, I felt this acute just realization that the sickness was not purely pathological. There was an element of the stress and the emotion that he had been absorbing was making him sick. And his inability to run was causing that. And I don't know, I'm not saying with certitude that, you know, stress gave him cancer, but I think there was a component to that.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times when he was in the coma, I would try to tell him as best I could to just let it go, just to release what he could, because it wasn't his to bear. And I think that was all part of his healing.
Yeah. The healing being multifaceted. On the one hand, you know, what is the opportunity for him, right? Perhaps there are other ways for him to process all of this outside of running, and there's an opportunity for him to explore some other modalities. There's an opportunity for him to figure out how to have some healthy boundaries, so he's not, you know, in this osmosis where he's just, you know, like a sponge for everybody else's bullshit. You know, I think there's something interesting there. You know, and that's probably really uncomfortable for him, I would think, because like running is, you know,
well, especially now that he can't
run. He can't. So he's now he can't run away from this, and he has to figure out other ways.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, he still does go out for, you know, a couple hours a day, but it's not the same. He can't, there's not that catharsis of just endless, like just rigorous miles and glycogen depletion and all of that. So he's, we're both figuring out these new selves that we find ourselves in, the post illness, so, and we're also getting to know each other in that way, you know, we're both very different people now. So
yeah. Who is he without being a professional runner? And you have to redefine what those roles look like and how you're interacting with each other.
And learning how to just be, which for both of us is very hard, you know, just to be. And I think that
it's the worst.
We're both, he especially, and in reading your book, you and Rives are quite similar in a lot of ways, in self-discipline, self-determination, extremism. And he has a hard time not pushing the limits and not just having a goal and reaching the goal. And then what's the next goal? And so we're realizing that one of the hardest parts of being alive is to just be. And that doesn't mean being stagnant and just sitting around and doing nothing, but feeling fulfilled being. And that's where what I'm trying to do right now is, this book didn't make me happier, you know? And I think in some part of my mind, I thought that reaching this goal would make me happier. And realizing that accomplishments don't do much but stroke our egos, you know, and then we're left with that kind of, not crash, but just realizing, okay, I'm still me. I'm still a mom. I'm still, you know, I'm still Steph with all of my problems and issues, even though I accomplished this goal. And so my next goal is just be. It's a hard one.
To be goalless.
To be goalless, yeah.
That's terrifying.
It is. And for Rives too. And we're both in the same place where we're just really trying to just be. It's hard.
Yeah. I had my friend Light Watkins on the podcast the other day. He's a meditation teacher, and he said something along the lines of, you know, the happiness that you will experience when you summit Everest is the happiness that you brought to the summit, right?
Oh,
it's not
going
to change, right? Like, that's between you and you outside of any kind of externalities. And that is the Mount Everest decline, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Of the whole thing.
Yeah.
How is his health now? How is he doing?
He's good. Yeah. I mean, other than the lung damage, which is what more or less irreparable. I mean, I think they can see small improvements, but he basically has COPD from the tumor damage. But he's doing what he can, and he's healthy. He's cancer-free. Yeah, so that's all we can ask for, you know? Yeah.
I want to go back and explore your background a little bit and your kind of relationship with religion and spirituality. Growing up in a Mormon household and being this sort of rebellious youth, like, walk me through the salient aspects of that.
Yeah, so I was raised in the LDS religion. My mom had converted when she was 14 years old and met and married my dad, who was not Mormon, which in itself is kind of an anomaly. Was if you know Mormons, you know that you're taught to marry other Mormons. But so I was already raised in a household that wasn't 100% culturally Mormon or even genetically Mormon, you know. And still, I had this firm belief in the faith. And when my father got sick, I truly believed that my faith could heal him, that if I prayed enough and that if I was obedient enough, that he would be healed, because that's what I was taught, both like really overtly, actually. If you have a perfect faith, miracles will be granted. And so when that didn't happen, when my father finally passed away a few days after my 14th birthday, I completely dispelled any notion of not only religion, but of spirituality and inspiration and any notion of hope, because I felt so deeply betrayed by those notions. And so if God and faith weren't real, then nothing was. And so I could do whatever I want. And so I drank, I think I was 4 days after my 14th birthday, and I got drunk at a house party, and I cried. I spent the night crying under a dining room table. It was, my big brother brought me home. And I feel like that was it. And I didn't ever realize that I was drinking because I was grieving. I really thought I was just making a normal teenage decision. It really took me maybe 5 or 6 years to realize that the path I was on, the destructive path I was on, maybe was a result of my father's death. And that's how disconnected I was from myself.
Right. You're unconsciously reacting and responding to this trauma without really understanding why you're doing what you're doing and thinking it's for other reasons. And this is the point. This lives within you. It's an entity until you heal it.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I went down, I also feel as though, and again, this is something I read in your book, which I appreciated, that there was something bigger than myself always looking out for me. And even though I didn't believe in that thing, I could have, should have been dead or in jail, or, you know, so many things should have happened to me that didn't. And I feel like there was always something stopping me from going over the, pushing the limit, just that last little bit. And now I wonder if that was my dad, which was something I would have never, ever even entertained that thought up until Rivs got sick. And I don't know. I still don't know, but I wonder.
Was there a conscious impulse to, like, numb the pain, or was this just, I'm partying like everyone else? And or was there a sensibility of searching for some kind of answers that would replace that fall from grace that you had with Mormonism?
I think it was this feedback loop where I drank because I wanted to, because I was angry and I wanted to feel. And it was only when I was drunk was the only time I allowed myself to cry. And it was the only time that I kind of allowed myself to feel anything at all. And so I was doing it, but then I was feeling guilty because I was raised Mormon and raised to believe that, you know, any kind of drinking or any kind of partying was a sin. And then that made me feel guilty. So then I would drink more because I felt guilty. And so I was just in this just downward spiral. And obviously none of it worked.
Yeah. And when you were able to emote, when you were under the influence, like I'm curious about what the relationship in your household growing up as a kid was with kind of sharing your emotions openly. I mean, how was that?
Yeah, we didn't do that.
Yeah, not a lot of that, right?
We didn't really do that. I mean...
That's shocking.
Yeah, I mean, and I talk to my mom about it now, who, you know, I portray her in this book as this British stoic, which she was. She was very, very stoic and beautifully so. I think that her strength and her lack of showing emotion actually just carried us through. And then it was our responsibility later to learn how to grieve. And I feel like for me, that was the perfect way to do it. I know that people could say, yeah, you weren't able to show your emotions. It wasn't that we weren't able to, it's just we didn't know how.
And when your father passed away, how was that explained to you by your mother? And what is the emotional residue of that experience?
We didn't talk about it. Mm-hmm. We didn't talk about, it was, you know, I came home, he had passed away while I was out at Walmart. And, you know, she looked at me, said, "Dad died." We were expecting it. It wasn't a shock. And that was kind of, that was that.
Right.
You know, there was no, there was real, and I think now, and this is one of the wonderful parts of writing this book, is I realized why she did that. And because talking to your children about grief is an impossible task and one that I was having to confront. And it wasn't until I had to confront it for myself that I realized that she did it perfectly because there's no way to do it. You're grieving and you're trying to tenure the pain of your own children. It's impossible. And you do whatever you do, and that's the right way to do it.
Right. It's another example of the universe lining up to, you know, infer an opportunity out of this. Dad lung cancer, Riv's lung cancer. This is how my mom dealt with it and communicated to me when I was a kid. Now I'm in that position, and I have this very difficult choice, and I now appreciate more deeply how difficult it was for my mother, so I can forgive her, have more empathy for her, maybe make different choices, but heal whatever wounding that existed over the way in which she parented you and communicated with you.
Yeah, absolutely. And that I didn't actually realize the depth of that healing until I was writing the book. And a lot of times writing is how I make sense of the world. And it wasn't until I was writing all that she did for me and the parallels between our lives at really around the same age, when my dad was sick, she was quite young too. And it was just kind of this aha moment that, oh my goodness, I am in my mother's position and I am doing pretty much the same thing that she did. I'm not able to talk to my kids very well about the possibility that Rivs might die because I don't know how to say these words to them. It's impossible. And I did show more emotion to my kids. But again, I don't think I did it perfectly. I'm sure in 10 years, they're going to turn around and criticize the way that I led them through that tragedy. And I'm expecting it.
It's rigged that way.
Yeah, it is.
It wouldn't matter. Whatever choice you made, they're going to have their issues with it, and they can talk to their therapist about it.
Write a book about
it. You know what I mean? And be mad about how you didn't do X, Y, or Z.
Exactly.
And that's the way it should be, right? This is how the species evolves. But it is, again, one of those dualities. Like, you want to be strong, make sure that your kids feel safe and protected and that, you know, everything is going to be okay. But you also want to have that open channel of communication. You want to be able to model, you know, vulnerability and, you know, what it looks like to go through something hard imperfectly. I think that's an important lesson as well. And those two things are in tension with each other. And I think probably every parent who's had to deal with some kind of difficult issue and how to communicate to their kids about it, you know, butts up against that.
Yeah, yeah. It is. It's an impossible task. And a lot of people actually, one of the most asked questions I get is what advice do you give to a parent going through something similar? Mm-hmm. And I don't have any. I wish I had advice. I wish I could write out a formula for the perfect way to lead a child through tragedy, but there isn't one. And also, each child is so different. Each of my children have dealt with Riv's illness so differently, and it's not one size fits all, you know? And so it's, you just do your best and they'll be fucked up no matter what. No, I'm just kidding.
I know, right? But I think that yes, like, it's important to not just give blanketed advice for this kind of thing. But one thing that you make clear in the book is you had to overcome, like, you were sort of operating under, like, you know, like, I'm protecting them. Like, they don't need to know the details. And then, you know, the just the overwhelm of all of it leads you to a certain kind of breakdown, and you end up opening up to your kids, you know, somewhat in a vulnerable way. And that was received well.
Yeah.
Like, it was received with empathy.
It was.
And I think what I take from that is, when in doubt, like, don't underestimate your children's ability to appreciate the humanness. And I think that they will end up respecting you more if you're transparent with them. If you're hiding something, because, and even if you're doing it for the right reasons, like, you want to protect them, that's what leads to, you know, distrust and all kinds of other stuff. And that doesn't mean that you're just, you know, unfiltered in all of it. You have to be responsible. But I think there's a lot of wisdom in understanding, even if they're young, and obviously what age they are is important, that kids are resilient and maybe they can't handle everything, but they can probably handle more than you might suspect.
Yeah. And I guess that's a good thing to point out, was I was keeping from them some of the details of what was happening and the severity of those relief details, that Rivs could probably die. And that's what I was keeping from them. But I was not holding back with my emotion, with, especially with Harper. You're referencing me breaking down in Harper's arms. She was 10 at the time, and she pulled me in and she comforted me. And I hope that was a beautiful moment for her. Probably really tragic and sad, but also just realizing that my mom is human. Because growing up, my mom never felt completely human. She was just this incredibly strong, powerful, like, just unmovable person. And I tried to emulate that.
But it's hard to connect with someone like that.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that, I hope that Harper can learn from me sadness. It's okay to be sad. That's something I never knew, was it's okay to be sad. And I'm trying to model for my children that sadness isn't a negative emotion. I mean,
it's an appropriate response to a very difficult situation.
Yeah. And that we can feel, like, you know, as the premise of this book, Everything All at Once, we can feel sadness and fear and love and joy all in the same moment. We don't have to choose. And that was huge for me to learn.
It's also an expansive definition of strength. We think of strength in very narrow terms. Like, to be strong is to be taciturn and to, like, keep your shit together or whatever. But I think it's a different kind of strength to allow yourself to experience difficult emotions and to do it with people you care about, because you have to trust them, and it takes a certain strength to do that, even if they're your children.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And Harper, for better or worse, is also an empath. She is Riv's incarnate. She is, I see it in her. And I think that's also why I felt comfortable breaking down in her arms, because it was almost as though she was the wiser one in that moment. I felt like she could feel the vastness of all of it, and she could take it. Yeah. And so,
as long as, the only caveat I would add to that, as long as she isn't made to feel that it's her responsibility.
Absolutely. You know? Yep. Yeah. And that's kind of how I ended that chapter, was hoping that they knew that my sadness wasn't something that they would ever have to carry, because someone else's sadness, you can't carry it. You can't take it upon yourself, and you can just comfort them in those times.
Yeah. Back to the sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Yeah.
I love stories like this where I'm like, oh yeah, let's get into it.
Yeah.
Despite your adventures, you know, with errant boyfriends and vans and, you know, trolling around the valley in Los Angeles, et cetera. I never got the sense that you really had a problem with drugs and alcohol. I felt like you're in weird codependent relationships with boyfriends who had problems.
Yeah.
And so you're going to AA meetings because that's what they need.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but then the problem is that because I don't have, this is going to sound weird with how many tattoos I have, but I actually don't have an addictive personality. Uh-huh. Like Rivs and I are different in that Rivs is extreme and it's all or nothing. I am actually quite moderate in a lot of ways that I am able to.
But you like the extreme dudes.
I do. And obviously.
This is your addiction.
This is the addiction, yeah. And the problem is that I can do things moderately and they can't. And so a lot of the guilt of my adolescence was I'm leading all of these people away from sobriety. Because I did it on a few occasions just in my book.
Right. And you're the temptress.
I'm the temptress. And I don't mean to be. I like to have a good time and I could do it within parameters,
without
you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But what is it you think inside of you that leads you to be attracted to these extreme personalities?
Yeah, good question. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'll get back to you on that. But I think that there's something extreme about me. I mean, obviously, I'm covered in tattoos. And somehow, I am able to do moderation. Or something is keeping me from going over the edge. And I still haven't figured that out. That's still what I'm trying to figure out is mm-hmm. why am I not going over the edge? And so I'm still figuring all of this out. It's quite new. Yeah. It's still new to me.
Yeah. Well, you got lucky in picking an extreme dude in the form of Rivs because typically, like, they don't come in such a healthy package, right?
He's extremely healthy. Yeah. That's the extremism. Yeah. But, I mean, he has a tendency toward, I know he spoke with you about this, the addiction of the opiates. He's sober now. And that's huge for him and for me, too, because it kind of, it helps me to, I feel like it's going to be a long path, but I feel like I'll get there.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I think it's tangled up in this ongoing reckoning with spirituality
at
the core of your searching.
Yeah.
And in thinking about the inflection points along that timeline, there's another interesting one, which is when you decide to go to BYU in Hawaii, and you have this encounter with this bishop and you make this choice to be kind of more honest than perhaps that guy was used to
or wanted.
And getting a surprising response from him.
Yeah. Yeah. So part of being admitted to BYU Hawaii, which is a Mormon, obviously, institution, is you need to go through an ecclesiastical endorsement. And so basically there's a checklist that they ask you, do you abstain from drugs, sex, alcohol? It's like, no. And I knew I was going to quote unquote fail.
Right.
And when I told him everything, I divulged everything. And really at the time, it did feel like a fuck you to God.
Uh-huh.
It felt like,
because everyone else is just saying yes to pass the test.
Yeah.
And they're checking boxes.
Yeah. Exactly. And you can easily
lie. Do you
drink
coffee? No.
No?
Yeah.
No. Why? Never. And so that, I also added that into my story, him saying, you know, those things don't really matter. You're a good person. And I added that in, that true story in, because I kind of, you know, dog on Mormonism a bit in my book, but I also wanted to show that there's good people there. There's good people everywhere. And just because that religion didn't resonate with me, it doesn't mean that it's all full of self-righteous bigots. You know, there are good people in those religions. So.
And he gave you kind of a surprisingly capacious response that allowed you to reframe that resentment.
Exactly. Yeah. But didn't stop me from partying at BYU
Hawaii. That's
also
okay.
The question is, why did I choose a Mormon college?
Right.
You know, it's almost like
you'd already
like to
rejected
push,
that.
Yeah.
So how, that was a question that I had. Like, how did you end up there?
Yeah. And I think the answer is, and maybe going back to why am I think that I want so badly to be I wanted so badly to be good and I just didn't know how to do it. And I didn't know what good meant. And all I knew was good was what was taught to me in my religion, which was abstinence.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously it's so much more than just that. And that's something I'm still learning.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, but it's a search for, maybe not necessarily a search for goodness, but a search for somebody to tell you that you're good, right?
Yeah.
Or to make you feel okay with who you are. And that's exactly what that bishop did.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
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 It is fascinating that you ended up going there.
Yeah, it is. I still wonder.
Right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And so what does that look like now? I mean, everything all at once. Mm-hmm. This is a, you know, non-dogmatic, expansive, you know, concept of spiritual energy and the way that the universe works.
Yeah.
That you can't quite put a name on it. Mm-hmm. You don't attempt to do that.
Yep.
It seems that the overarching energy here is love, but like, how do you define your relationship with the unseen?
Yeah, it's ongoing, it's evolving, it's different from even when I wrote the book. When I wrote the book, I felt very certain about what I had felt and seen. And now as I get farther away from that experience, I question more and more. I'm a cynic, so I will question no matter what. But when I reread the book, I realized that it was very true to me, the spirituality of it all. And I can't deny, as much as I want to deny, that there was a strong spiritual component to everything that happened. It was. When I walked into Riv's room when he was sedated, I felt more connected to the universe than I ever had in my entire life. And moments that should have been terrifying and tragic and sad were some of the most love-filled moments I'd ever experienced in my life, sitting next to my sedated husband on two different life support machines. And the only way I was able to explain that, well, try to explain that, is that it was this otherworldly love that was just in the room, and it was palpable. You walk in there, and I even talked to the nurses and the doctors and, you know, the therapists that were in the room, and they agree there was something transcendental happening in that room, and I couldn't deny it, and they can't deny it. Even the doctors were like, there was some miracle and magic going on in this room, and I can't explain it, and I don't know what it was. I like to believe it was part my dad that was there. I love to believe that. Some form of God, goddess, but it was love. No matter what you call it, it was love.
The doctors recounting their version of that story being unique to Riv's.
Yeah.
Because they're in that scenario every single day with different people, right?
Yeah.
So what is it about Riv's that helped co-create that type of shared experience, do you think?
Well, interestingly, what they said was it wasn't necessarily him, but it was the bond between us.
Right.
That was felt transformative, which shocked me. One of his first nurses wrote me a letter about how she had never met him awake. She had never seen us interact, but somehow the palpable love that she could feel changed her whole idea of love. And I wasn't trying to do anything, and he was asleep, but I think it was a beautiful connection, that not only between me and him, but the love that I was bringing from the world, and almost as though I was a conduit and kind of transferring that love into him. And it was incredible. And it was crazy. It felt I felt like a lot of times I would leave that hospital room and I felt like nauseous, as though I was the empath all of a sudden. Like I was absorbing and transferring, which is something I had never ever experienced before, but I'd heard Riv's talk about it a bunch. And it's almost like we switched roles and I was able to do for him what he had been doing for other people.
Right. Well, you're also, for the first time, shouldering responsibility for your own growth and personal well-being, right? This transition from thinking Riv's is going to take care of it, he's all powerful, to suddenly, oh shit, I have to do this for myself, and then I have to go home and figure out how to do it with these kids in private while I'm suffering and grieving all at the same time. And then on top of that, the doctors, or it was one doctor, I think, who said to you, listen, you know, a huge part of whether or not he's going to make it is up to you. Mm-hmm. You're a part of this healing process. Like, what are you bringing to this equation?
Yeah.
Which speaks to exactly what you just shared. Like, are you contributing to his improvement?
Yeah.
Or are you, you know, sucking life out from underneath him
right.
because you're dealing with too much already
right.
and you're upset because he's not going to fix you anymore?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, and that's what I found is every day that I went in there, it was, I think, 101 days. And he was sedated for 50 of those days. And I went in I didn't miss a single day. And every day that I went in, I felt more and more alive and connected to myself in a time where I should have been falling apart. And part of me was, but recognizing that the fullness of me is falling apart. That's okay. It's okay to feel strong and completely weak at the same time. It's okay to feel anger and gratitude at the same time. And the more that I accepted the monism, not even duality, like how complementary these mm-hmm. feelings were, not contradictory. And the more I allowed those complementary emotions, the more powerful I felt. And as I get farther away from that, I don't feel it as much, now. And I think that a lot of times we have the choice to become our best selves in the worst times. And somehow I became my best self in the worst time of my life. I don't know how. Again, I wish I had a guidebook, but it was just recognizing the power that had always been inside of me. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't in RIVs, and realizing that I was more powerful, not necessarily on my own, but in this moment where I didn't depend on him.
Yeah, you had a capacity that was latent within you.
Mm-hmm.
And pain and challenge is the crucible mm-hmm. for connecting with that
yeah.
and sort of bringing it forth into the world. So that's the opportunity,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
The interesting thing is if you co-sign to the idea that all of us have capacity mm-hmm. and potential that we're walking around with that mm-hmm. we're just not aware of or
yeah.
We haven't really, brought forth in our own lives. Do we really need to be in that kind of a tragic event or to suffer
yeah.
extreme pain
yeah.
in order to manifest it?
Yeah.
It's a choice.
Yeah.
It just rarely happens.
It rarely happens.
Short
unless,
of, mm-hmm. Basically being boxed into a corner in yeah. that kind of a way.
Yeah. Well, similarly, Rivs and I are, for lack of a better word, happier together than we've ever been. And people are like, how are you so happy? I'm like, just make him almost die. And then you'll
right.
you'll go through together this recognition of how much you love each other and how important you are to each other. And things that we take for granted that are sometimes only shown to us in the depths of despair, sadly, how do you access that feeling of gratitude and awareness when you're not in the depths?
Right.
And I'm struggling with that
yeah.
now even.
Please tell me how to do that.
Please, yeah, right. Yeah. Oh, you don't yeah. know? Oh. 'Cause I'm now even, I want to maintain the lessons I learned. Be present. There's no better moment than this moment right now. And all the love you ever need is inside of you. All of these truths, I know them, but it's harder to feel them when life is good.
Right. And imagine your RIVs where your whole life is oriented around connecting with suffering
mm-hmm. yeah.
as a vehicle
yeah.
for growth and truth and self-understanding
right.
and appreciation. And suddenly that preferred voluntary version of suffering is replaced with a different type of challenge,
mm-hmm.
overcoming this illness. And then on the heels of that, stillness.
Mm-hmm.
The suffering is not being able to engage with your chosen version of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
It's a yeah. passive suffering.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that is much more uncomfortable
yeah.
for him. It would be for me.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and also I think there's a physiological component to the metabolizing energy. That alone, he literally was using the energy that he absorbed from other people to metabolize his
yeah,
runs.
Had to and now transmute it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. And now that he can't do that, he has a hard time being around people.
Right.
That's the truth.
Yeah.
Because he can't absorb, he absorbs what he can't metabolize.
Is he actively searching for alternative ways of doing that?
Yeah, yeah. I think he's yeah, figuring it out. But it's a journey for sure. Yeah.
I want to talk about the time malleability stuff, mm-hmm. this sort of quantum idea.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, if you're RIVs and you're in a coma, and you come out of it, you're going to have a unique relationship with time.
Yeah.
But time is a bendable concept that is influenced by the extremity of what you're experiencing. Mm-hmm. Time slows down, time speeds up, et cetera. But in this quantum sense, this idea that like there is no past and there is mm-hmm. no future, we're on this sort of recursive loop where everything is happening all the time in some dimension, mm-hmm. is a fascinating one. I'm curious as to whether that was initially prompted by your psychedelic experiences.
Well, I was going to say, yeah.
And it's something that I'm dealing with right now. And in a different way, I've got a family member who's suffering from dementia. Mm-hmm. And to just observe that person, you know, their relationship with time mm-hmm. is complete. You know, like they could be 1 minute, they're living 10 years ago. Yeah. And then that's got to be scary, but also, you know, it's bizarre because then you have to visit that timeline.
Yeah.
And, you know, memory is an anchor for time, mm-hmm. right? And our relationship to memory is a way of time traveling, yeah. I guess, on some level. So walk me through this whole concept that yeah. is really the whisper in the background on every page mm-hmm. of this book.
Yeah, well, and that's even why I wrote the memories that tethered me to myself throughout my life are written in present tense, because what I learned and what I'm learning is that memory is the cursor to things that are always happening. These memories are actually ever present, and we can access them and go back to that time in a moment.
Well, they're consciously or unconsciously impacting every decision yeah. that we make. So they do live in the present.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. Absolutely. And I mean, the starkest example of this was when Rives was at the end of his life, and I went in there to say goodbye, is what they told me to do. And I rested my head on his chest, and in a moment we were dancing together, and we were living that moment together in the present. Mm. And nobody could tell me that didn't happen, that I was not metaphysically there, because I was. My body was here, but I was there with him, and we were dancing together. And that memory, I feel, drew us back together into this world and called him back to this life. And I think that example was why I wanted to weave the malleability of time into my whole book, because I realized that it was memory that was saving me over and over again, mm. mostly the memory of love. And that's what I feel kept me my whole life from going over the edge. These ever-present moments of presence that I was called back to. And on the other hand, Rives, he lived lifetimes in his coma. He has some incredible stories about where he was and where he went and how many different families he had. And who's to say that those weren't real, that those weren't really occurring lives, you know? Mm. I would never say. He says some of those memories of when he was in the coma feel more real than this life memory, you know?
Wow.
So I'm really, really interested in the quantum aspect that I wish I understood on a physics level.
Yeah.
But all I know is my experience with time. And
So what do we take from that? How are we supposed to interpret that? Or how is that meant to, from your perspective, inform our lives?
I mean, really, it's that love is woven into every aspect of our lives in the form of memory. And that in the most tragic moments, love or the memory of love is still there. And I like to think of my father, whether he exists in a spiritual realm or just in a memory, I think that the memory of his love is the same as saying that he lives in some spirit world. And that love is entwined in every aspect of my life, and it's in all of our lives. And if what one of the most pivotal moments of my life today was recognizing how that love had been in everything, absolutely everything. When I was drunk crying under a table, when I was hitchhiking through Guatemala, when I was, you know, everything that I did, love was there. I just didn't recognize it in myself, so I couldn't recognize it in other people.
How do we tap into that? Do we have to, you know, do psilocybin? Like, well, I want some of that juice stuff.
Have you ever done psychedelics?
I haven't.
Okay. Yeah. And I know, okay, so that's probably touchy because psychedelics. Okay.
It comes up all the time on the podcast. Yeah. We talk about it a lot.
Because you've had Gabor Mate here, right?
So, yeah, I've had lots of people, explored this extensively, and I won't bore the listeners with my perspective on it. I only to say that because I'm sober, I have trepidation around it, but I also can't dismiss or deny the efficacious, benefits that I've seen many people have and the interesting science that's coming out about how it's helpful for people with depression and PTSD.
Yeah.
But on a purely, kind of spiritual plane, I'm interested in the epiphanies and the truths that then seem to persist well beyond that experience. Oh, yeah. And in your case, clearly, have informed your entire worldview.
Yeah. Well, I really do credit psychedelics with my ability to handle Riv's illness the way I did. It was only 6 months before he got sick that I did my hero mushroom journey. And that's what cracked me open to the possibility of spirituality. And I think had I not had that experience, I might not have been open to even the idea that Riv's existed somewhere other than in his body. Maybe I wouldn't be open to the fact that I could conduct love into him through some spiritual cosmic channel. And I really think had I not had that mushroom experience, I wouldn't have been able to do the things that I did with and for him. But that being said, I know some people who are kind of militant about psychedelics and think it's the only way. I think it's the quickest way to get there, but I do believe there are other channels. My sister-in-law is a quantum healer and she does like the holotropic breathing, meditation. But of course that takes a lot more time and mental energy than just drinking a tea and going right there,
So, although holotropic breathing will bring you there pretty quick.
I've never done it. I'm terrified.
We do these retreats and Julie, my wife, takes people through holotropic breathing exercises. And in our past retreat, our most recent one, she took everyone through it like on day one. Like, let's just cut through the shit right now. Like, people were having insane experiences. And everyone would go around the room and share afterwards. And like, I was an eagle and I was flying,
What's really cool and what I love about...
breath.
Yeah, my mom is, she's Mormon still. And she is on this whole journey where she went to Thailand. She's mostly vegan. She did a vegan cleanse and did a holotropic breathing experience. And, coming from a really like Puritan religion, that's not accepted really, this outside spirituality, but she did it and she said she saw Jesus and Buddha and they were both equally important. I'm like, there you go. And for her to...
The expansiveness.
Just, I love that, that's what she saw and they were both equally important. And so I do think that psilocybin is wonderful. For me, it worked. I haven't done another hero trip since because what I needed at the time...
What does that mean, hero trip?
Well, you take... like 5 grams,
like a
massive dose where you complete dissolution of ego. Like I didn't know who I was, where I was. But I needed to do that because I was so dissociated from myself. So I needed something to, and this was only, 4 years ago. I needed something to crack me open and to show me I had been compartmentalizing my grief. I'd been compartmentalizing my feelings. I wasn't fully healed. You never really are. It's okay to feel everything all at once. I needed that shaking. But I don't need that now. I was shook. Riv's illness cracked me even wider open. I don't need it right now. And I think it's recognizing when and if you need that rewiring or that, restructuring of your brain and your thought patterns. And I'm recognizing that I'm still on the trip. You know what I mean?
Right.
I'm still going. And I know they recommend doing it something like every 6 months, but I cannot fathom.
Who is they?
This mushroom people. This
my brain's
imagine.
Like, can I do it every day?
Well, you can microdose, but that doesn't do it for me. That didn't ever do it for me. Although it did help me get out of depression once, microdosing. But anyways, I don't think it's a blanket. I think some people use it as the be-all, end-all answer. I don't think anything is,
Right.
I think you got to
see
what works.
Yeah, I mean, the way I think about it is it's a portal into a state of consciousness that would otherwise be difficult to access,
mm-hmm.
not impossible.
Yeah.
And for some people, that's just enough mm-hmm. to shift them and get them interested in a different way mm-hmm. of navigating the world yeah. that otherwise they would never have, you know, yeah. been open to, yeah. I guess.
And I got there when Ribs was sick every day mm-hmm. without the need for any substance. I got there every time I was in his room, felt like that kind of transcendental experience. But like we've been saying, do you have to go there? Do you have to suffer
right.
to feel it?
Maybe you do.
Maybe you do.
I don't know. It is a very hero's journey kind mm-hmm. of architecture to this story. I'm sure when you're in the middle of it, like anybody who's challenged by life, you're thinking, why is this happening to me? I finally had this life and I worked mm-hmm. so hard and I did all these things and suffered and explored and now I'm happy and then all of this is happening. Mm-hmm. Why and what? But when you look in the rearview mirror, it's like everything's lining up perfectly mm-hmm. for this experience. Obviously, you're choosing events and moments mm-hmm. and imbuing them with meaning
yep.
To create a narrative,
right.
which is not any more real than some other, if you had chosen a whole bunch of other events to imbue mm-hmm. them with meaning. So there's a lot of human imposed ingenuity on top of it. But when I look at, first of all, your dad wasn't the first person in your life to suffer from cancer. You had, right. you had a brother.
Yeah.
Like you met that at, how old were you? 13 or something like that?
I was six when my brother.
You were super young,
right? He was
right?
three, I was six.
Yeah. So that was your first, universe yeah. is knocking. Hey, yeah. here's a little thing.
Yeah.
How are you going to deal with this? Yeah. Oh, wasn't enough here. Well, let's throw your dad into the mix yeah. and see what happens here.
Yeah.
I guess she's going to have some more adventures.
Gosh.
And, and then,
I know.
Okay, well, I'm going to drop an anvil on, yeah. on this person's head
yeah.
in the form of, ribs and a rare form of lung cancer. And also, 6 months prior to that, you go off and do this psilocybin mm-hmm. thing, which is sort of seeding you or preparing you to have a different experience this time. With a new lens that would allow you to navigate it with an expanded perception yeah. of meaning.
I'm really weary. I don't like saying that. I see,
but it is. I know what you're saying.
But I do.
The universe
see
didn't
it.
Decide to do all of these things for you.
Yeah,
I understand
right.
that.
Because that. Yeah.
But can you find meaning in
yeah.
them and extract that meaning to grow and evolve,
yeah.
I guess.
Well, and more than that, how could I look back and not see how it was a little eerily, not predestined, but everything, like you said, lined up so perfectly. I hate it, but I can't deny that it did feel very meant to be in some
right,
ways.
You're like Luke Skywalker
yeah,
in your
right?
own movie.
You know what? I don't ask why did these bad things happen to me, because far worse things happen to people. And I'm very aware
sure.
of that. And I really am. And I don't think I've had some tragedy filled. I've had a very beautiful life. I chose to tell the tragedy side of my life, but I've had a pretty good life.
Well, first of all, you're being careful to not portray yourself or be perceived in any way as a victim.
Right.
Right.
Well, yeah.
And also that you're not the main character in
yeah.
some grand, architecture of
right.
the universe conspiring just for you.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Like you're just a person living your life.
Yeah.
Things happen.
Yeah. I never asked, why did these bad things happen to me? I really never have.
Mm-hmm.
But I ask, why did all these good things happen around these bad things? Why did I get so much guidance and love and assistance throughout my life when so many people are left alone? And I think that's the why that I ask. It's almost like a survivor's guilt. Like, why was I so lucky to have so much love in my life when I know a lot of people don't have that? And and so in some way, that's why I wrote the book as this tribute to love itself, because I've had so much of it and wanting to honor that is the thing that kept me alive my whole life. But that is the why that I ask. Why me? Why am I so lucky to have that help?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You were talking about goals earlier, and certainly, you had a goal of writing a book and having people enjoy it. I'm sure you've set other goals in your life, but at the same time, you don't strike me as like a plotter and a planner. You strike me as somebody who is living your life based on gut instinct
yeah.
and you're making spontaneous decisions and you're not really thinking that far ahead,
yeah.
right? And And life has worked out, which maybe mystifies you because you didn't plan it or you're not thinking ahead. You're just, this is what my heart is telling me. I'm going to jump and go here, which I think is a really beautiful way to live. I know some other people that live that way. They're just like, I never worry about, as long as I'm connected to my heart and it feels right to me, I do it and I have faith and trust and I can make a leap. But that requires like a level of trust in your own instincts to guide you.
That's spot on. Ribs and I always joke that I'm just the ultimate coaster, and I always have been. I've just allowed life to happen, you know, and I allow it to happen, and I'm just there for the ride. And bad things have happened along the way, but somehow it's always worked out for me. But there's someone like Ribs that plans every moment of every day and knows what 5 years from now is going to look like. And I don't even think about today. I don't know what I'm going to do this
but
afternoon.
But when you're not thinking ahead like that and things go well and you're surrounded by love, it's impossible to not believe that on some level you're being guided and taken care of.
But you also can't prescribe that to other people, because I think it's also could be dangerous to live that way.
What's interesting is that it worked out given your level of disconnection from self, because I would say to somebody who operates that way, make sure you're really connected with who you are. Otherwise, that gut instinct is just some weird memory that you're being prompted by and you don't know why. And that can all go terribly wrong. And often it does.
Yeah. And that's why I do attribute some of my earlier life survival really to something I can't explain, because I wasn't connected to myself and I was extremely reckless, and still it all worked out. As a 22-year-old, I chose to marry Rives, who I was partying at the time and I was reckless and wild, and he was just off his mission, like a really sweet Mormon boy. And somehow he finds me.
Where did he go on his mission?
Brazil.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And did he have a beard at 22?
No, you're not allowed.
I can't even imagine what he looked like.
You can't. He was really, he's handsome, but he has like a really good jawline. But again, I like, why, how did that?
And it's what was it about him?
Again, well, what about him? I mean, what wasn't it about him? Yeah. But I mean, what was it about me? I feel like we just knew. And I, as I write in my book, when I saw him, it was almost like another one of those memories. Like, I know you. It doesn't make sense, but I know you somehow. And kind of like how you said in your book that you said you were going to marry your wife, right, that day. And I'd never felt that way before. I didn't even think I was going to get married. I thought I was just going to coast my whole life and be a beach bum. And then he walked into class and it was just, oh my gosh, there you are, you know? And
that's some past life shit.
Yeah, exactly.
Or just this cyclical nature of time and the bleeding of past and future together into an interesting present.
Present for now. And again, like, that malleability of time, this isn't, my friend Vanessa in Flagstaff says, this isn't your first rodeo, Steph. Mm. You know, the way that life has lined up for you, it's not your first time. You dove into this knowing exactly what you were going to do and who you were going to meet. And when she used to say that, I was like, oh my gosh, that's such bullshit, you know? And now I'm seeing it unfold and it's truer every day. So,
wild. Yeah. Have you seen the movie Arrival?
Yeah, no. No, I don't think so.
Oh, this is your homework stuff.
Okay.
I'm assigning this movie to you.
Arrival.
Denis Villeneuve. It's a science fiction movie. Aliens come. But it's really about our relationship with and our perception of time.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what the movie is about. And I think it's going
to
blow your mind.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
So you're
going to
watch that.
That's what I'll do tonight. Okay, now I have a plan for the first time in my life.
In addition to the quantum time, past, present stuff and the duality themes, there's also, I guess this is sort of a cousin to the non-dualism aspects of the story, but the story's also about what lives in the between spaces, you know, the liminal spaces between death and life, right? Between day and night, between religion and spirituality, and what lives in between anger and happiness, gratitude, et cetera, or the mundane and the sacred. Mm-hmm. So how do you think about that? Or how did you kind of plant your flag in that murkiness?
Well, that was a huge theme I wanted to explore because I was raised to believe in polarity, in, you know, good and evil, and sin and obedience. And that damaged me so much as a child because I believed that perfection was the goal. And if I wasn't perfect and living on that end of the spectrum, then I wasn't doing it right. And time again, life taught me that life exists between the extremes. It's not good or evil. It's not right and wrong. It's everything all at once, really, essentially. And when I came to accept that the best of life exists in the gray areas, in the liminal areas, then I was almost able to accept the wholeness of myself because I am good and bad and happy and angry. And I always tried to give moral weight to my emotions, you know, that gratitude was a positive emotion and anger was a negative emotion. And I truly believed I had to choose between them. And then recognizing that there is no moral weight to emotion. They just are. And they're necessary. You know, anger is equally as necessary as gratitude in a lot of cases. That was shown to me by recognizing how anger in my adolescence actually fueled me and kept me alive. When I think, had I not had anger kind of fueling me forward, I probably would have been far more self-destructive and just kind of desolate. And it wasn't until Rivs got sick that I learned to appreciate that side of myself, the rageful, angry side that was really essential to who I am. And then on the spiritual side of that, Riv's room was the in-between. It was that it wasn't life and it wasn't death. And it was a place that I still don't have words for, but it was like a sanctuary. And I felt more alive in that space between life and death and more connected than I ever had and I think part of it is, again, going back to time. Time didn't exist in that room other than the monitors, you know, beeping and kind of like bringing me back to the present. Time kind of suspended when I was with him. And we could be in Hawaii together and we could be caught up in all these memories or past lives, whatever you want to call them. And time ceased to exist. And it was a really sacred, sacred space. But again, all of this happened in between.
Yeah. I'm just wondering how I can connect with something, some semblance of that into my life. You know, it's a peak experience.
Yeah.
And then it's about the judgments that we attach to it. And thinking about your Mormon background, a very binary structure, right? Good, bad, evil, whatever. And then realizing, to use your words, that actually, there's a fluidity to truth.
Yeah.
And anger is not necessarily bad or being sad. It's a story that we attach to certain emotions. But to your point, these emotions are neutral. Can we embrace those aspects of ourselves with the same, you know, level of compassion that we would embrace the aspirational emotions that we're all seeking, right? Meaning, purpose, happiness, love, et cetera. And that's a challenge because we have this programming, you know, we're supposed to be like this. And if we're not like that, then there's something wrong with us. And that judgment that we levy upon ourselves, that punishment is the antithesis of the compassion that we're striving to import to others. And yet, are incapable of providing for ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's interesting is it is a Christian notion that duality, you know, light can exist without darkness. But what I found was it's not contradictory, it's complementary. And that's a more Eastern Buddhist way of looking at things, that it's not light versus dark, it's light and dark together. And just like it is gratitude and anger together, they complement each other. And if they're complementary, why should we shun one or exclude one? or favor one over the other?
I don't know. Why do we do that?
Why do we do it?
You know? I wish we didn't. There's so much freedom on the other side of that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I felt it when Ribs was sick, that love for my brokenness that, you know, I'm not feeling it as much anymore. But during that time, I was like, that's why I am who I am today, is because I went through that and I was reckless and that built me to the person I am today. How could I regret those things if they've taught me what I know now, you know?
Right. And those broken pieces, those fractured, splintered aspects of ourselves, ultimately, you know, on the other side of healing, become the most beautiful pieces, right? What is that Japanese art where when the china breaks, or, you know, they piece it back together with beautiful glue and it becomes a much more prized, cherished possession as a result of it because of its flaws.
Yep. That was in my head a lot as Ribs was sick, that I just had this feeling that something, no matter the outcome, I was going to choose to make this to make me stronger. But I knew it was a choice, you know, and I was going to choose to make it make me stronger. But it was obviously a conscious, and still is a conscious choice that I have to make.
Yeah. Is it going to be a crucible for your growth, or are you going to allow it to destroy you or define you in some unhealthy way? Or are you going to become a victim? The narrative that you associate with it becomes very powerful because it reinforces meaning, and that meaning can be fluid, just like everything else that you speak about in the book, right?
Yeah.
And that's a choice just like anything else. And I think my favorite, this is, you know, on a similar vein, like my favorite quote out of the entire book is when you say, human frailty is the great mason of becoming. To me, that like says it all.
Explain,
you know, what's behind that for you.
Well, and again, it comes back to the danger of not wanting to say that being broken makes us stronger, because it doesn't, everyone. But it is, we are given a choice in those dark moments, in the moments of tragedy. Will you choose to make, like, allow this to make you stronger, or will you choose to allow it to break you beyond repair? And I think that it's a choice we can make 10 years down the road, because I think that my father's death, the narrative I told myself about my response to grief in my adolescence, was that it broke me and I was reckless and I allowed it to break me. And now I look back and I say, wow, that was building me the whole time. And even though for over a decade I told myself that I had been broken, really now I reframe and say, I was being built that whole time. All of the recklessness was building me to the wisdom that I have today. And so it really is, that tragedy is a mason, and we can choose to build ourselves stronger. But it's, again, it's a tricky and it's a tightrope to walk. And that choice has to be made daily. Yeah. It's not a choice that we make and then it's everlasting, you know?
Yeah. Looming over this whole thing is this non-dualistic idea of love. It's all about love. Love permeates everything. There's a little bit of like, give me a fucking break. You know what I mean?
Like,
you know, it's like you're exposing yourself as an easy target for somebody who is maybe woke up on the wrong side of the bed. So help me understand what you're really getting at here. Because when I think about love, I mean, I agree with you, but I also think of love showing up in different ways and in different forms. Some love is conditional. Some love is temporal. Certain relationships aren't meant to last forever. They come together, a beautiful thing happens, and then time passes, and that relationship is complete. And then there's the eternal love. Julie, my wife, likes to describe it as the sun that is shining. The sun is not discerning. If the sun is emitting rays of light, which are love, it's not discerning where those rays are shining. Yeah. It shines equally upon everyone without judgment, right? That's a different type of love. I suspect that's really what you're getting at here, but walk me through this for the skeptical naysayer, you know, brain that's listening
well,
to this
me,
right now.
Well, me, had I read this book 5 years ago, I would have been like, wow, okay. Really, I mean the universal love, this ineffable love that is everywhere and unconditional, and how that exists.
Easy for you to say.
Well,
beautiful, with your beautiful kids and your
I know, exactly. But it is there. But I didn't see it. I didn't recognize it until just a few years ago because I didn't have it inside myself. And I think that it's just a reflection of what we have to give ourselves. And like I said earlier, I was searching for that love outside of myself over and over again, and I was trying to fight it in drugs and alcohol and men and countries. And it was an insatiable thing because it didn't have a receptacle inside of me. And so the love that I'm talking about is just a reflection of what we can give ourselves, because it really is all around us all the time. You can see it in anyone walking by the street if you choose to see it, but you're not going to see it if you don't have that self-love inside of you. And again, it's a daily decision that I make to love myself and therefore feel more love for humanity and more love from humanity.
Is there a structure or a modality for practicing that? Like, what does that actually look like?
You're asking me. I have my agent asked for an outline to my
Here's
book.
Here's my list.
No,
of, here's
like,
how I do this
outline.
Every single day.
Yeah, I never wrote an outline for my book. It was just going to happen. But
that's why it took you 10 years.
Yeah, it's true. But I thank God it did, because it would have been a different book, you know, 5 years
sure,
ago.
Of course.
Again, that timing, that cosmic timing thing. But you're right. People are going to say, yeah, easy for you to say. You've had love throughout your life. But I also I'm choosing to see in retrospect the love throughout my life. It's another choice that I'm making to say, I could also look back on my life and say, wow, I had a really tragedy-filled life. All I knew was hospitals when I was a little kid. My dad died when I was 14. 20 years later, the love of my life almost dies. I could choose that narrative. I could tell that. But I'm choosing to see the love woven in and out of all of those stories. Yeah. And it's a choice I make. And it is easy for me to say, but it's also not. I could tell a very different story. And I'm choosing in my book, I choose to show that universal love through the actions of other people, you know. But it didn't really matter who it was coming from, because I do believe that the source is the same. It's just our human interconnectedness. It's this love that in psychedelics you see very tangibly, that God is love, and that's the current that's connecting us all. And so it's a choice to see it or not see it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no framework. Maybe there is, but not in my mind.
Yeah. The truth that everything is one, like all the atoms are connected, you know, the we're mostly open space, this table, our bodies, the energy that we share, it's all a common singular thing. Despite that truth, it's impossible for me to maintain that sensibility in a practical sense throughout my day.
Oh, me too.
Maybe psychedelics help get you there on some level. Certainly, we'd probably be in a better place as a planet and a culture and whatever if we could really grok that. But I'm wondering about, and I know, like, advice, like when people ask you for advice, you start to cringe a little bit. Like you have a discomfort with telling anyone what to do, which I respect and appreciate. But the person who's suffering, who needs that healing and that message the most, is the most difficult person to connect with, because they're encased in that shell with a certain narrative and a pain body that makes it very difficult. That's the person who will be the first to dismiss anything that you would have to say about this.
Yeah. But I've also been that person.
And so have I.
And that's the thing is I wrote this with old me in mind, because I knew what I would say had I read certain lines in this book, you know, only 4 or 5 years ago. But I couldn't deny that that was the truth that I found. And I wasn't going to filter myself because old me would have torn it apart. And I know that my book isn't for everyone because I know it's not going to resonate with everyone. But someone who is suffering and without love and lonely, first of all, can you find that love inside yourself? Yeah, right. I mean, in moments of despair, you can't. And I know that because I've been that person. But as the like the malleability of time, can you remember a memory of love? Is there something that tethers you to love a moment, even if it's a stranger? And what did that feel like? And where did that come from? And as a practice, choosing to recognize or remember those memories maybe can lead you more to seeing how love is all around us. But or just do a hero dose of
psilocybin.
And
then you're like shirking.
Oh,
you know, just own it, Steph. That was beautiful.
Thanks.
Just like, this is about you standing in your power.
Yeah, I know.
Right?
Yeah.
That's what the book is about.
Yeah.
Don't shy away from it.
Yeah.
That was great.
Yeah, well, thank you. On my way here, actually, I was having some self-talk about why do I have such a hard time with advice? I don't know. I'm working on that. I'll let you know.
I do too. Like, I like to have conversations with other people and ask them for advice.
Yeah,
but then when people ask me for advice, I'm like, why are you asking me?
Yeah, right?
Yeah,
it's uncomfortable for me, and I'm trying to figure out why. But
well, I think a charitable interpretation is it doesn't feel right to tell another person what they should or they shouldn't do.
Yeah.
You know, that feels like a close cousin to taking someone's inventory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the tension in the duality here is that you've had a certain set of life experiences that have taught you a few things that can be helpful to others when imparted in the right way.
Yeah.
And you're a vehicle for that.
Yeah.
The book does it. It's not outright saying, do this, don't do this.
Right.
But it's saying, here is an experience. Take from it what you will. And my hope is that this will improve your life or maybe give you a few things to think about that can change your relationship with whatever your experience is.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's doing it, and this is like an AA thing. It's like we don't tell people what to do. We don't give advice. We share our experience,
right?
This book is you sharing your experience.
Yeah.
So you're comfortable doing that.
Yeah, I'm very comfortable.
And so I think that's healthy, and maybe that's just because this is the way I see it too, and I want to feel like we got it right.
That it's not a deficiency.
Yeah. Especially when you're online and you're scrolling on Instagram or whatever, and people are like looking to camera and they're telling you what to do.
Yeah,
there's something
very
powerful about that
absolutely.
People respond to.
Yeah.
But it also makes me very uncomfortable. Like, I don't think I'm the right person to be like that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, and also because I believe so firmly that most truths are relative to our own personal experiences.
Yeah.
So who am I to say that this is...
No, my partner has cancer. What should I tell my kids?
Yeah, well,
there's supposed
a lot
to
of people,
be some general... I'm sure you get asked that question a lot, right?
Yeah, I do. And I don't respond because I just stammer through some kind of, you know, blanket statement because
nobody wants to hear it depends.
It depends. Yeah. Do what you think is right. I mean, no, but I it's just everything. And part of what I write in my book is that truth is so, it's like a kaleidoscope. It's just a twist of the risk depending on your perspective and your experiences. And my truth has changed so much throughout my life. And again, me reading this book I wrote 5 years ago wouldn't have resonated. So I think I just have to understand and accept that my book, this book isn't for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's...
Who is it for?
Well, really for me. And the truth is...
That's what an artist does.
Yeah, I wrote it for me. And even now, reading it back, I see how a lot of what it will be criticized for is because I wrote it for me. And I didn't really think much about other people reading it. And actually, the night before it came out, I had a total meltdown because I was like, oh, shit, people
it's
are going to read it.
But if you had thought about that while you were writing, you would have edited yourself. You can't do that.
Yeah, that's true. And so I'm glad it is raw the way it is because that's the story I had to tell myself for myself. That was me making sense of my life for me. And if other people can gain something from that, great. But if not, then I just have to be okay with it being me bearing my soul for myself.
Nothing great is for everybody.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's a big world out there, as Seth Godin says.
Yeah.
And my hope for you is that 10 years from now, you'll revisit this book, you'll read it, and in perfect non-duality, or a duality here, there'll be part of you who's really proud of you for having the courage to tell this story and being able to like recognize the beauty in it. And another part of you is going to cringe and say, oh my God, I can't believe like I wrote that.
I already know I will because I'm already starting to be like, wow,
because
I really did it.
You have grown, you've continued to grow and you've transcended, you know, some of the ideas that you were struggling with when you wrote it.
Absolutely. Yep. I hope that for me too.
Yeah. I guess as a final thing, is there, we covered a lot, but like, I guess I feel responsible in asking you, like, is there a core idea beyond what we've already discussed today that you were trying to express in this book that we didn't cover?
I mean, I think we covered it just between the lines, but just self-acceptance. And that was what I was really trying to do, was accept myself throughout this book, is write for me a narrative that would allow myself to accept and make sense of all of the recklessness and all of the craziness, and accept it all as the beauty that makes me me now. And that couldn't have happened had I not gone down all of the dead ends that I thought were dead ends, which were really, now looking at it, were probably like bridges to myself. And so really it's just that self-love and self-acceptance.
Yeah. Again, it's that rear view thing. Mm-hmm. Like, well, when I went to Guatemala, you know, or all these things that probably in the moment you're like, why am I doing this? Or what am I doing with my life now? Seem integral in, you know, building the person that you are today.
Yeah.
I think the final thing I wanted to ask you also was that your relationship with shame, you know, coming out of the strictures of a religious upbringing and then being a rebel, right? Like there has to be some residue of like in that department of self-love. The other side of that is like the deep shame and unworthiness because you're a bad person, that seeking inside of you, like, just tell me I'm a good person, or how do I become a good person?
Yeah, absolutely.
Is a response to that shame, right? An antidote to that.
Yeah. I try really hard not to dwell in shame because shame is something I want my children to rarely feel. I know they can't come out unscathed, but shame is such a large part of Christianity, really. And I've seen how it crippled me for a long time and a lot of the people that I love. And I really try not to embody shame because I don't want my children, especially as three girls, to grow up and trying to emulate that. I think it's Brené Brown that said the difference between guilt and shame, and that guilt is actually actionable. And I do have guilt. Like when I read my book back, I feel guilty for poor Jane, and she was sober for 6 months and then she got drunk with me, and I feel guilt for that. And I think guilt is just taking responsibility, but shame, I feel like, is just a dead end. There's no purpose for shame. It's just, there's no actionable purpose for it. And so I think I want to teach my kids the difference between those two
things. I think the ripple to that is guilt. I think this is what Brené said. Guilt is an emotion around something you did, and shame is an emotion around who you are.
Yeah, exactly. But in religion, they're so tightly entwined. I mean, you're taught that your actions are who you are, you know, that drinking makes you a bad person in the Mormon religion. And you really are taught that, and it's really ingrained. And so trying to separate those two things, being, you know, what I do isn't necessarily who I am. And I think that was also exemplified by that, the bishop who told me, you know, I hear you list off all of these quote unquote sins, but you're still a good person. And that right there, I think that's the split between, you know, action and
what you do
and who you are. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And he wasn't exonerating you from taking responsibility for it.
Yeah.
But he was distinguishing behavior from identity.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Beautiful.
Yeah.
I think we did it.
I think we did it.
Yeah. the book is fantastic. You're inspiring. Tommy is inspiring. You together is truly a, you know, 1 + 1 = 10 equation. And I wish you guys the best. And
thank you.
Tommy's continued recovery, and I hope to see both of you in the future.
Thank you.
What's coming next for you? Are you into another book, or is it day to day going from the gut? Is it going to take 10 years for another book?
Well, who knows? I don't know. I already started writing another book, but it's not a memoir. Mm-hmm. It's not a memoir. It's a novel. So we'll see where that goes. Yeah. Wow. I think I'm done with the memoir.
Yeah. Well, I think you got a little bit more life. Yeah. You know, it's like 1 year later, memoir.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Yeah. But in the interim. Yeah. And then also, like I said, learning just to be, and maybe it's okay not to have another project on the table. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can, you're like, your skin is crawling, you know, at that, right? As somebody who lives out of their gut instinct, you should be okay with that.
I will. We'll see what happens. Yeah.
All right.
We'll
just
see.
Well, absolute delight and pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Everybody pick up the book, Everything All at Once, at your favorite bookseller, independent bookstores, hopefully. If not, Amazon.
They should be everywhere.
Your website. Yep. I'll link up all that stuff in the show notes and come back and talk to me again sometime.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Cheers. Peace. That's it for today. Thank you for listening. I truly hope you enjoyed the conversation. To learn more about today's guest, including links and resources related to everything discussed today, visit the episode page at richroll.com, where you can find the entire podcast archive, as well as podcast merch, my books, Finding Ultra, Voicing Change, and The Plant Power Way, as well as the Plant Power Meal Planner at meals.richroll.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, the easiest and most impactful thing you can do is to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, and on YouTube, and leave a review and or comment. Supporting the sponsors who support the show is also important and appreciated. And sharing the show or your favorite episode with friends or on social media is, of course, awesome and very helpful. And finally, for podcast updates, special offers on books, the meal planner, and other subjects, please subscribe to our newsletter, which you can find on the footer of any page at richroll.com. Today's show was produced and engineered by Jason Camiolo, with additional audio engineering by Kale Curtis. The video edition of the podcast was created by Blake Curtis, with assistance by our creative director, Dan Drake. Portraits by Davey Greenberg. Graphic and social media assets courtesy of Daniel Solis. Thank you, Georgia Whaley, for copywriting and website management. And of course, our theme music was created by Tyler Pyatt, Trapper Pyatt, and Harry Mathis. Appreciate the love. Love the support. See you back here soon. Peace. Plants. Namaste.